With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Hey, welcome everybody to episode 31 of the Bomber Brothers podcast, the Aaron Hicks episode, and Sean and Ryan with you. Sean, we're getting closer. We're, less than a week from pitchers and catchers now reporting as we record here on Thursday?
A little closer.
Well, how are you holding up?
I'm surviving. I'm, the Super Bowl was pretty boring, so,
That's an understatement.
I'm looking forward to some baseball because, to me, a pitcher's duel is more exciting than a defensive-minded football game, which I'm not even sure that was. There really wasn't a lot of impact hits or anything like that. I mean, it was a good defensive game plan, but it was a boring game. I found myself very disinterested, and the post-game scrum was probably the most interesting part of the day with I'm sorry, I forget the field reporter's name. Just
Tracy
screaming,
Wolfson.
I got him. I've got him.
Tracy Wolfson.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was about the most exciting part of it. And I totally agree. There's something about like a pitcher's duel where everything just seems to be hanging in the balance in every at bat because one mistake could end in a ball into the seats and that could change the whole game or even, a successful stolen base. And all of a sudden, all it takes is a single that finds the right spot and that could decide the game. So there's something about the tension of a pitcher's duel. And hey, I also love watching, a game five of the 2017 World Series with Astros and the Dodgers when there's just home runs and lead changes every half inning. But I also love a good game five of the 96 World Series where it's Pettit and Smoltz in a 1-0 game where, of course, that's different than just a regular season game because it's the World Series. And in that case, the series was tied. But, there's just the heightened tension of a pitcher's duel is definitely, in my opinion, more exciting than the whatever it was we watched on Sunday.
Yeah, it wasn't very, very exciting. That's for sure. I think I was thinking about it while I was watching the game. I'm like, why is this so boring to me, but baseball so exciting? And I think it's that in football that, let's say 80-yard plus play where you're not really in scoring range is so rare. But in baseball, I mean, you could hit a home run on an 0-2 pitch and nobody would really, they'd just be like, oh man, the pitcher messed up. Mm-hmm. So it's that anything can happen. Anything can happen moment that I think, makes baseball a lot more exciting. Anyway. Yeah.
And we're getting closer to that exciting baseball, and there could be some changes to baseball, which we'll get to after Ken Rosenthal's article came out, and a lot of interesting potential changes to look at there. And we also have Ben Lindbergh on of The Ringer and of the Effectively Wild podcast. So he's usually hosting podcasts, but we get to interview him on this one today, and that'll be fun. And then some other interesting tidbits we can look at. Baseball Prospectus released their annual Pecota projections minutes before we started recording, so it would be fun to give an instant reaction to that. And looking at it right now, it has the Yankees winning the American League East by 6 games, 96-66 over the 90-72 Red Sox, who, unsurprisingly, BP has them finishing much, much better defensively than the Yankees, which is certainly hard to argue with. And then, you know, venturing away from the Yankees real quick before I dive into the individual numbers, but BP has the Mets and Nationals tying for first place in the National League East, so we could have two division winners in the New York area this year.
Yeah, that really surprised me, especially about the – both surprised me. I mean, I guess it's just that the Red Sox bullpen is so bad, and, I mean, what the heck are they doing? I mean, relievers are just flying off the board. I'm frustrated with what's going on with the Yankees, but, I mean, if I was a Red Sox fan, I'd be furious.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a lot easier for them to stomach considering they are the reigning World Series champions. But yeah, this isn't doesn't seem like the best course of action to defend that title when you see how crucial bullpens have been to postseason runs. And you know, I know Craig Kimbrel suffered pretty badly in the postseason last year, but the Red Sox also had a bunch of other relievers who, surprisingly, based on their regular season performances, were pretty strong in the postseason. So that kind of made up for it. Guys like Brazier and Joe Kelly had a couple big performances out of the Red Sox bullpen. So if they had played to their normal form and Kimbrel faltered, the Red Sox might not be where they are right now.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I'm surprised. I mean, bringing it back to the Yankees, I think that I'm surprised they're projected to score the most and give up the fifth least, I think, in the league.
Yeah.
I know they have a great offense, but I see so many holes there, and maybe that's just me being pessimistic. But I mean, do you trust a guy like do you trust a lineup that's going to feature Troy Tulowitzki, probably Brett Gardner? Like Clint Frazier wins that job. The uncertainty at first base. That's really a lineup that's going to score the most runs in the league. Like, I think they'll be good, but I don't think that good.
I think the X factor is Sanchez. I think if he comes back and he's his 2016 and 2017 self, then, you know, siding him along guys like Judge and Stanton, then I think just them three alone are enough to pace the Yankees to score the most runs in the league. And I think, you know, you look at these projections and they have the Yankees finishing with the most runs in baseball, and they do see Sanchez bouncing back and having a big year. They have him at the third or fourth best DRC plus, 29 home runs projected.
Going straight to DRC plus. I love it. Just got introduced, but let's go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've read pretty much all the articles that they came out with after they released the stat. It seems like an all-encompassing, pretty efficient way to evaluate a player. Obviously, we'll
seems
see.
Legit.
Yeah, seems legit. It's by people much smarter than me. But to keep it a little more basic, Sanchez had a .469 slugging percentage with 29 home runs. That's, I mean, that right there is comeback player of the year material. So that would obviously help the offense. Now, here is the one that surprised me the most. Luke Voit, I'll just say the DRC plus anyway, even though me and most other people won't know what it means, but a 128 DRC plus, which is, that's, I mean, I guess if you scale it, that's about 25% above the league average, and a .501 slugging percentage with 21 home runs. So they seem to love Voit and don't think he's just a flash in the pan. If Luke Voit hits 21 home runs next year and finishes with a slugging percentage over .500, and it has him at 404 plate appearances, I'm taking that in a second.
Well, I mean, we talked to Ben about if we think Luke Voit is for real, and it seems like the projections are for real. And, you know, I used to kind of scoff at these, but they predicted Greg Bird's disappearance pretty well a couple of years ago, and I remember all Yankee fans were like, no way, no mm-hmm. way, but I mean, they were right on that. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think they predicted too much of a regression from Judge, and they were right about that. Yep. Judge was for real. So, I'm encouraged by that. I think that's something that we've both been kind of wishy-washy on, what would happen with Voit. So, excited to see if that comes true.
And looking at... It looks like they're predicting a very, you know, pretty balanced attack from the Yankees. The only guy projected to finish over 100 RBIs is Giancarlo Stanton, who they have it hitting 39 home runs, so about the same as last year, with a 5.18 slugging percentage. That's the highest projection on the Yankees. Judge at 35 home runs, 91 RBIs with a 5.13 slugging percentage. Hicks 21 home runs, 4.39 slugging. And then, you know, you have Tulowitzki, Gardner, LeMahieu, all guys that are projected right above or below league average. And I guess the other important one to look at, Gleyber Torres and Miguel Andujar, seems like they're projected to have slight regression, still above league average, but 43 home runs for them combined, 22 and 21 apiece. So this is all stuff I would sign up for. And of course, this isn't perfect, but go ahead.
It all seems fair to me.
Yeah, and it's not perfect, but again, like we said, they were on the money with guys like Judge and Bird, and these are definitely better projections to go off than just, you know, a panel of writers predicting who will win the World Series, or, you know, going off of something just like batting average. In reality, nothing's perfect. Nothing is guaranteed to be even semi-accurate, but hey, we need some kind of baseball content, and it's fun to just look at these projections, especially when they seem to be favorable for the Yankees this year, even though there's still a bunch of superstars out there to be had that would even widen this gap even more of six games.
Yeah, I saw that. I think Ted Berg put up an article that the Yankees should just get it over with and sign Harper already. Which I agree with. Just go get the guy. I mean, what did you think about Judge coming out and sort of making his pitch to get him?
I loved it. I would love to see Aaron Judge in center field. And then, of course, some people take it as some kind of knock on Hicks, which was just ridiculous.
Right. Well, he didn't say, I'll play. He didn't say, like, oh, I'll go play center field. He said, I'll play wherever.
Yeah.
So I wasn't too I didn't read into that like a lot of people did, where he was trying to take a shot at Hicksy, but
yeah, but that should be the mentality that the Yankees have. This is Bryce Harper. He's a superstar. His swing is tailor-made for Yankee Stadium, and look what it did for guys like Curtis Granderson and Didi Gregorius, and Harper would come to the Yankees as a better hitter than both of them, especially power-wise. So you, of course, you're willing to move positions around to fit a guy like that onto your team. It's interesting because it didn't seem like the Yankees had a glaring need for Giancarlo Stanton last offseason, and they still made that deal because, of course, you do. That's the reigning NL MVP, and if you have a chance to get him, you do it, and you figure everything else out. And then, as it turns out, a bunch of people in the outfield got hurt last year, and you did really wind up needing him. So
Imagine that team without Stanton at DH Judge went down.
Especially the way he was hitting when Judge went down. That was his best month and a half of the season. So they would have lost the division by 15 games, but and maybe not even played in the wild card game. But anyway, so let's. You want to talk about these new rules that Ken Rosenthal reported on that could be coming to baseball?
Well, I think the DH one would hurt us because it would open up more teams to be aggressive for, you know, guys like Stanton and Machado, because they could always move guys around and everything like that.
I'm surprised you say that. I could see that on the grand scale, but just thinking like specifically on the field, I think of Chin-Ming Wong and Masahiro Tanaka, and I'm like, thank God. I don't have to hold my breath every time one of our pitchers gets on base.
Right. No, I think that it's time for the National League to adopt the DH. I enjoy the difference in the leagues. I think it's like a cool distinction that's unique to baseball. But when it comes down to it, I want to see the best players on the field, both hitting and pitching, and keeping pitchers healthy by having the DH and allowing good hitters that maybe don't have a position more at-bats. I think that's good too. So, I would definitely say that I would definitely say that I'm in favor of that.
I am too. There's still that group that says, oh, you're taking the strategy out of baseball. I mean, National League teams shift every at-bat. They switch defensive alignments all over the place. They still platoon bullpens the same way the American League does. There's tons of strategy in the National League and taking away a spot in the batting order that averaged, what was it, 111 last year with a strikeout rate of 41%, I think I saw. I mean, I'd be happy not to have to watch that anymore. Even if it means you don't get the occasional very rare Bartolo Colon home run, or I'm blanking on his name, but the triple for the Diamondbacks in the wild card game.
Archie Bradley?
I think it was Archie Bradley. But yeah, so I mean those things are incredibly rare. It's the same thing as when they got rid of the four pitch intentional walk because, oh well, what about when, you know, the pitch leaks back over the plate and Gary Sanchez hits it to the warning track. You know, those things were so rare, and I don't think anybody misses watching those four pitches anymore. And I don't think anyone will actually, people will miss, but I won't. I won't miss watching pitchers bat in the National League.
Yeah, I mean, there's an entertainment factor to it, but I think overall you're gaining by putting in the DH. And like I said, I think it could hurt the Yankees by opening up other teams in the National League to be more aggressive for hitters that otherwise they wouldn't be able to. But, you know, you seem to disagree with me, so that's fine.
Well, I guess I agree based on the current state of the Yankees and how they're approaching free agents and potential DHs. But I guess the way I think of it is, the Yankees shouldn't ever be at a disadvantage for getting players over other teams because they have more money than other teams. But since they seem to be unwilling to take control of that advantage, then I guess you're right. Then that could come and hurt the Yankees when it comes to potential free agents that National League teams can now slot into the DH role. And I'm sure teams like the Mets are one of the teams that are probably happy to have this coming along, especially after they just took on Robinson Cano's contract, because he is a perfect candidate to become a DH towards the end of his career, when he more than likely can still hit and be productive offensively, but his range at second base disappears.
Yeah, that's always a key. And plus it allows all teams to be more flexible and fit in more superstars. And I don't know if teams care about that anymore, but I sure as heck do.
Before we move on to the next proposal, I saw this on Twitter yesterday, and it really intrigued me at first before I realized it would, you know, mean less jobs for people in the MLB, less rest for players and guys like Stanton. But someone said, you know, there's all this debate about the DH, but has anyone ever considered just removing it and batting eight guys and not having a DH?
And like, I saw that.
For a second, I found it really interesting, but then you realize, you know, it's 162 games and you still want to have some of those bats like Judge and Stanton in the lineup, and you also want these people to have jobs, which is becoming more and more difficult every year, it seems like. So that was kind of a, oh, wait a second, actually, no, moment for me.
Yeah, I don't think that'd be the best idea, but you know, I mean, I think it would hurt the offense more than it would help. It would be entertaining to see players more, but like you said, then you're robbing careers of like Edgar Martinez, and as much as I dislike him, David Ortiz and everything like that.
Yeah. All right, well,
but what do you think about the pitching idea? Minimum three batters unless there's an injury?
I go back and forth with this one, but there's a part of it that really intrigues me too. I think it would definitely add to the tension of those later innings, because you know that you might be getting a mismatch somewhere in that stretch of three batters, and it becomes even more of an X's and O's thing with managers trying to figure out, you know, do I bring this guy in because he's dominated, you know, the lefties, but he's struggled against righties? Like, look at Zach Britton last year. His splits against lefties and righties were very different. It was a little scary. I think for Yankee fans, like, I instantly looked at the pitcher's splits, like Betances, Britton, Chapman, and all them, to see how they would fare if this rule were to be implemented. And Britton was definitely the one that made you the most frightened for that prospect. But then you look at his career splits and they're much more closer to normal, but for whatever reason, maybe just coming back from that Achilles injury last year, he was bad. So if you're Aaron Boone, what do you do with a guy like Britton in those situations? And I get it. I get why they want to do this, the enormous amount of pitching changes. While we love the strategy and we love the game, it's not just about the hardcore fans who they already have. They're trying to gain, turn the casual fans into hardcore fans or the non-fans into casual fans. And pitching changes and commercials, especially in the later innings when the tension's supposed to be the highest, I could see why people would be turned off by that who weren't previously turned on to baseball when they were younger. So I understand it. I think it could help, and I'm not completely opposed to it. I think, like anything, it's changed, so it's a little discomforting to think of something like that. And I mean, just the Yankees have great relievers like Chad mm-hmm. Green, Ottavino. They haven't changed much against whether it's lefties or righties. Chapman too. I mean, he still loses control against lefties and righties anyway, but his numbers against lefties are obviously incredible, but he's not used as a specialist, so I don't think it would affect him that much either. But it's definitely interesting, and I guess the more I think about it, the more I think that in terms of the way the Yankees bullpen is constructed right now, it would probably help the Yankees, because there's not many other bullpens in the league that are built as deep and as strong as the Yankees, and you factor in the Yankees' offense against bullpens that can no longer mix and match against, you know, Hicks and then Judge and then hopefully Didi when he's back and healthy. So it could actually wind up helping the Yankees.
I think it would help the Yankees more. I mean, I know you brought up Britton, but the Yankees are usually, most of their relievers can get anybody out. They don't have, like, you know, the Damaso Marte, Graham Lloyd guys on the team anymore. I think it would help the Yankees. And I think it'd be interesting, and I think it would add a lot of strategy, a lot more strategy to the game. I think I think it's pretty exciting. I thought it was exciting when I heard about it. I knew that a lot of people would have issue with it, but I would be up for trying it personally.
Yeah, I would too. I think it's a good start, a good idea. And then I can't remember who, I'm blanking on what article it was I read, but it was surprising for me to see that the percentage of relievers who have come in to face just one batter were actually down last year. And if they're down and there were still that many changes and everything, then maybe there does need to be a change made. Again, not for us, the hardcore fans who are going to watch baseball all the time no matter what, but for the people they're trying to gain. So it makes sense. And there are a bunch of other minor changes slowly dwindling down mound visits, which I think would be naturally rectified with this new pitching rule, because there would be less pitching changes. So that's not too big of an issue. Then we come to the runner on second and extra innings, which they want to start in the All-Star game, minor league, spring training. This, the first two, I'm on board. This one is where it starts to kind of lose me.
Yeah, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I don't know about you.
It scares me, because I would hate to see that in the major leagues. I don't like any mechanism that forces the game to end earlier than it should if you start changing the rules. I don't like how the NFL does their overtimes. I don't like how the NHL handles the shootout or the 3-on-3 overtime, personally. I think 3-on-3 is okay.
Wow, I like 3-on-3.
It's entertaining, and the Rangers played one of the most entertaining 3-on-3 games I've seen in a while last night against the Bruins. But it's not the same game. And in baseball, why do you have to do this? It's so rare that games go into extra innings that late anyway. I don't like it. I know some people will say, well, you know, the games end so late and everything like that, and I understand that. But at the same time, that happens so rarely. Why are you going to change the whole fabric of the game because of it?
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of like the opposite end of the spectrum as the intentional walk rule and the getting rid of the pitcher's batting rule, because those things are so rare. You're like, well, they barely ever happen, so, you know, what's the point of keeping them when we can increase excitement at the bottom of the order or trim down game time? So this is something that's also rare, so why even put in that change? You look at the game today, you put a runner on second in extra innings, and it seems like these days a home run is about just as likely as a single. So even if there's no one on base, just see if someone hits it out of the park and you get yourself a walk-off home run. I just think that's going a little too far. I can't exactly put my finger on like what it is that I wouldn't really like about it. I just think there's such thing as too much, too fast, and you know the other proposals they have I think are fine, and maybe just don't go too extreme all at once, because then you do risk alienating the established fans who like the state of the game. You know, find that happy balance.
Yeah, I mean, I just think about some of the games that you always remember, and those are the ones that are those back and forth battles and extra innings. And I get that games end and kids don't want to stay up late and everything like that. But, you know, most of the baseball happens over the summer when this would happen anyway, because obviously you wouldn't do it for the playoffs.
Yeah.
So kids are staying up late anyway. I mean,
it's fun. I remember the Yankees Red Sox 18 inning game. I think it was in 2015, and I would fall
asleep. Oh, God, I felt so terrible that next morning.
I would fall asleep. I would wake up like an hour later from a noise, and I would be like, oh, let me just go back in the TV room and see if this game's still going on. Then I would watch an inning or so, and then I would go back. Yeah, work was awful the next day. But, I mean, I don't know. Those are nights that you remember, and it's just fun. It's different. And that's something I wouldn't want to lose. And although a game like that could become an issue if the three batter rule is implemented, because then you get yourself tired bullpens much quicker, and then you wish that you would have stuck with maybe your starter a little longer.
Well, why would you think that you're saying that limiting the bullpen, not the three, well, the three batter rule would make it.
Well, the three, make you actually, yeah, never mind. That would have, they're expanding the rosters to 26, but only allowed to carry 12 pitchers. Right. That was the other proposal that we were going to get to next that I think would affect that.
Yeah, that's I agree with. That's smart. But I mean, that's still a boatload of pitchers compared to what they have today.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, I don't like the rule for shortening the extra innings, and I don't like the rule for controlling roster construction with the number of pitchers either. I think the three batter rule kind of fixes that for you. This is like a double fix, and the second one is not as good.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Let the teams construct it the way they want. It's, they want to have more pitchers, then I don't see why that matters. If pitchers have to face at least three batters anyway, I don't think it really matters how many pitchers they have. But anyway, want to talk to Ben Lindbergh?
Let's see what Ben has to say. He's got a new book coming out, The MVP Machine. It comes out in June. I know we've both, as we said, pre-ordered it. His last book, The Only Rules It Has to Work, is great. I recommend it to anybody who likes baseball. And MVP Machine deals with player development. So let's see what Ben has to say about the Yankees player development, and then we can talk about it ourselves.
Yeah, Ben Lindbergh of The Ringer and Effectively Wild came by to talk about Yankees player development, Luke Voit, Aaron Boone, and some fun video game stuff. So here is the former Brian Cashman intern, Ben Lindbergh. Okay, we are joined now by Ben Lindbergh. He writes about baseball for The Ringer, and he hosts the Effectively Wild podcast on FanGraphs, and also has a new book coming out soon, The MVP Machine. Ben, thanks so much for joining us. I think, not to blow your head up too much, but I think Sean and I are more excited for this than almost any other guest we've had so far since we started this.
I apologize to all the other guests for outshining them, I guess, then. Thank you.
Well, the MVP Machine, it comes out in June, I believe. And so just to start, you know, we know the size of the Yankees analytics department, and you were a former Brian Cashman intern, but just how much of when you were writing that book did you see the Yankees themselves being at the forefront of this new movement in terms of identifying talent?
Quite a bit. Yeah, the book is about player development. development and some of the cutting edge technology and techniques teams are using. And the Yankees definitely came up often as we were reporting it. I would say that there are other teams that are a bigger presence in the book solely because the Yankees won't talk about anything. So they're extremely secretive. So, you know, we ended up talking to people with other teams who were a little more forthcoming, more so than the Yankees, but that's not because the Yankees aren't just as into all of this. They very much are. In fact, I think they have the largest player development staff of any team in baseball. They had more than 100 people working in player development in some capacity last year, whether it's, you know, coaches or trainers or managers or sports science people. They really are on the cutting edge, and you see it when players go to the Yankees. You know, there was a notable story last year when Zach Britton came over from the Orioles and his mind was blown by just all the numbers and all the tools that were at his disposal. He just didn't know that these things were out there. So I think the Yankees do a good job of providing all of that info to their players and developing, you know, young pitchers. We've seen them just manufacture relievers and sometimes trade them and sometimes bring them up, but they seem to be very proactive about that, and they've definitely invested in the technology and the staff.
So another piece you recently wrote for The Ringer was about the Yankees' almost cartoonish height, which they only added to with DJ LeMahieu. Not exactly the tall infielder that many Yankee fans wanted, but nevertheless, DJ LeMahieu's a Yankee. So what do you make of the Yankees' overwhelming sense of height and these, you know, big sluggers that kind of seem like they allude to an older time when you have smaller sluggers like Mookie Betts and even Jose Altuve, Alex Bregman? So just what were your thoughts when you were putting together that piece?
Yeah, I don't know if it's an intentional strategy or just something that's happened, but it's funny. You know, they went from Neil Walker, who was one of the tallest second basemen ever, to DJ LeMahieu, who is the tallest second baseman ever. And of course, they've added Tulowitzki and they traded Torres, and it's just giants all over the place, obviously, with Stanton and Judge. But, you know, really everywhere other than Brett Gardner, everyone is really big. And this is, as I mentioned in that article, an era where there's less of a connection between height and power than there has been in many decades, like almost 60 years. The correlation now between height and isolated power is lower than it's been. So you don't have to be big anymore to hit home runs, and you really don't have to be big to hit home runs in Yankee Stadium. And yet they seem to have accumulated the largest lineup in baseball and possibly the largest lineup ever. There are some configurations that they could throw out there this year that really could be the biggest lineup ever. So what does it mean? I don't know. I mean, they've certainly accumulated a lot of guys who hit the ball very hard, whether it's Stanton and Judge, who are just kind of on another level, or guys like Luke Voit, who also hits the ball very hard. So obviously that's smart, right, to get guys who mash, and it just so happens that they've gotten a bunch of really big ones. I don't know that it means that much, but, you know, you go up to Yankee Stadium if you cover the team and you're just craning your neck at everyone, because it's not just the hitters, but it's the pitchers too. I didn't even cover that in the article, but, you know, right after I wrote that, I think they signed Adam Ottavino, who's another big guy. They're just huge all over the place, and I don't know, I kind of like just the symbolism of it, I guess, just having the big bad Yankees be literally huge.
So you mentioned his name, Luke Voit. He's a big bad brawler looking guy who just mashed in the second half of last season, but what do you make of Voit in terms of next season? Was that a flash in the pan? Was this another Brian Cashman steal? I know they liked his opposite field power at Yankee Stadium. Do you see this as maybe not the 1,000 OPS, but was his production sustainable?
Yeah, I mean, I think the obvious thing that probably everyone will say is that there will be some regression coming just because of how incredible he was, and, you know, probably the best deadline pickup anyone made, just about. I don't think that he can hit at that level for a full year. Not many people can, but he definitely does hit the ball hard. He is a big guy. His stat cap OPS numbers were pretty impressive in 2017, even when his superficial stats weren't that great. And it seemed like the Cardinals liked him, but he was kind of blocked at first base there because they had Martinez, they had Carpenter. He just wasn't getting much playing time. And it seems to have been a pretty astute pickup to just go grab a guy who hadn't really broken through in the big leagues yet, but had those underlying skills and just didn't have a place to put them into use with his team. So, I mean, I've been a big Greg Bird fan, just going back to his minor league career. And when he came up, I remember writing something glowing about him for Grantland. And I continue to think that he has some skill and that one of these years, maybe he can put it together. But, you know, you have injury after injury and you start to worry about whether a guy either is injury prone or just has been damaged so much by his past injuries that maybe the skills aren't quite there yet. So I'll be interested to see what happens there. They're both very large, so they fit right in with the rest of the lineup. And I don't know, I keep thinking that there's more in Greg Bird if he could just stay on the field. But right now, I think you'd have to give Voit the upper hand. And it certainly seems as if he could continue to be productive. And first base these days in baseball is not really a position where there are that many mashers, even though historically that's been the case. We're kind of in a little lull right now with first base hitters. So I think maybe the combination of those two guys may give the Yankees some pretty good production compared to most other teams.
Yeah, and Ben, not only the acquisition of Luke Voit, but the Yankees also have made several deadline moves over the last 2 years, and they've been noted for dealing more of their higher level AA and AAA level prospects. And that's also been notable because not many of them, especially in the last 5 years, have really panned out for the teams that acquired them. Do you think that could be in relation to the Yankees development system, in where the Yankees know exactly what they have and what they've invested in the guy, and maybe they know what other teams don't, and that they've put enough into this player and it's just not going to pan out the way that maybe scouts would think it would?
Yeah, I think that's plausible. We've definitely seen more trades around baseball than we used to, and I think that could have something to do with it. I talked to a number of people with teams while we were working on the book just about trading, because we've seen in so many cases, most notably the Astros, but lots of teams will acquire someone and make some tweak and say, hey, we think you could be even better than you've been if you just threw this pitch more often, or maybe threw in this location more often. And you see that a lot of times, where you'll pick up a guy and, you know, maybe you'll be happy with him if he just continues to play as well as he has in the past. But a lot of these teams will just trade for a guy and then immediately sit him down and have a meeting with the coaches and the analytics people and show him some heat maps and suddenly change his approach. And so I think that is something you're seeing more and more. You're looking for guys who maybe are just not utilizing their skills as well as they could, and you try to target those guys and go get them. And, you know, it works in the other way too. If you see, based on the data that you have, and, you know, every team has minor league TrackMan data, for instance, but there is information that each team has about its own players that other teams don't have, you know, whether it's, say, Rapsodo type spin information that can tell you how efficient someone's spin is, or wearable data that can tell you about some of his on and off field behavior and makeup stuff. I mean, there's always been kind of an information asymmetry there, where you know more about your own players. But I think, if anything, that has grown now. And so it certainly could be the case. Of course, the Yankees have kind of always traded prospects, and that's how they work. They, you know, go get established guys and sign free agents. And, you know, relative to the past, they have committed more to their homegrown products than they had in the past. But I think maybe they're just churning out so many attractive pitchers, particularly, that they can just kind of use those guys as trade chips, and it doesn't really hurt their major league roster.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, you just alluded to that the Yankees are relying a little bit more on their up-and-coming players rather than going out and getting the big free agents. And that's really been something that's changed since, I guess, the 2014 offseason, where they kind of went a little bit crazy. But the rest of baseball seems to have followed with that. And obviously now we're in period of labor uncertainty, especially I know looking down the road with the CBA. But what role do you think the Yankees have played in sort of influencing the culture and pulling back that always going for it attitude and being a little bit more restrained?
Yeah, I mean, they're one of a few teams, many teams really, that are pursuing that course right now. But I think to have the Yankees do it and to state publicly, or at least imply publicly, that that's what they're doing, probably does give other teams some cover when it comes to that. I mean, if the ultimate free spenders are suddenly kind of hoarding their young players and worrying about the luxury tax and all of that, I mean, this is the team that just mints money more than any other franchise. So if they're thinking this way and saying it, then it really, you know, makes it almost more acceptable for anyone else to say it or behave the same way. So I think that is part of it. And, you know, I mean, committing to young players is something that I think makes sense, just even aside from the money and the spending. That was kind of always the criticism of the Yankees, that they would not develop young players and they'd have to go out and get free agents who were past their prime. And then, you know, they would just be less productive and they'd have a bunch of guys on the downside of their career who were maybe more injury prone. And, you know, maybe there's an element of mercenariness to it also, so that if you're a fan of the team and they just keep importing players, you don't identify with them in the same way that you do with someone you saw come up and mature in your team's uniform. So I think they're doing sort of the same thing that everyone else is trying to do right now, and that has proven to be the way to win, historically speaking. And that kind of correlates with less spending under this current MLB structure that was collectively bargained, but seems to have really backfired for the players right now, because we're just seeing all of the talent concentrated in baseball in these young players who are in their first few years of service when they're really not getting paid. And so teams are just getting all the value out of them in those early years. And then by the time they reach free agency and they're maybe headed downhill, teams are saying, well, we've seen what happens in the past when you commit to these older players and they just keep declining. And, well, why should we sign someone to an 8-year deal if we can just make some technology tweak and maybe we can make someone obscure just as productive as this brand name guy? So this is something that's happening all over baseball, and the fact that the Yankees are leading the way probably has as much to do with that as anything, just because they kind of are the team that, you know, when they were spending a ton, everyone had to spend to keep up with them. And if they're not going to be pushing the payroll limits, then they're not exerting that upward pressure on the rest of the league.
That's a great point. And another thing that the Yankees have sort of followed a league trend in is the hiring of Aaron Boone, who's noted to be a much better communicator than Joe Girardi. But in my observations in the first year, I felt that he did show some rookie managerial mistakes and things like that. But whereas Alex Cora, who was also a rookie manager, seemed to be a little bit more seasoned, maybe from having his bench duties. But either way, the players seem to really have enjoyed playing under Boone and only have glowing things to say about him. Do you think that that's a trend in baseball, where maybe some of these managers are coached up a little bit more, so a guy like Aaron Boone, who is a good communicator, does understand the X's and O's a little bit more, and so he's not so overwhelmed by, like, say, his first postseason or something like that?
Yeah, front offices are really attracted to these younger and less experienced managers for a few reasons, I think. One of them is that they think maybe they'll work better and connect better with young players who are populating the rosters these days. Another is that if a manager isn't set in his ways and doesn't have that authority from having managed for decades in the past, then he'll be more receptive to front office input. If the front office says, hey, we want you to shift, or we want you to set the lineup this way, or this is how we want you to handle your pitching staff, you know, they're not going to be so set in their ways and feel like everything that happens on the field is under their control. And so I think there's more of a collaborative relationship there. Another thing is that if you're an established manager, historically speaking, you get to pick all your coaches and you have your whole coaching staff. And sometimes those coaches are good, but sometimes they're kind of like the manager's drinking buddies. And, you know, they may or may not be the best choices for coaches. And these days, teams are really trying to continue to develop players in the majors. And so they want the major league coaches to really be part of that player development process that extends all the way down through the minors. And they want to have them be, you know, up with all of the latest techniques and technology. And so if you're just kind of bringing back these retreads who entered the game in an earlier era, maybe you're not getting that from them. So I think that's why we're seeing more and more guys like this. But I do think, as you're saying, there is some advantage to having been there before in some capacity, and for Cora to have been the bench coach with the Astros and to have seen how things work and how that decision making works, just to kind of get his feet wet, probably did benefit him with the Red Sox last year. So I don't know, hopefully there's maybe some happy medium where you're not pulling everyone directly from the broadcast booth or retirement, but, you know, maybe they have some brief apprenticeship somewhere, at least just 1 year, you know, so that you're not throwing them into the deep end. I think that could help. And, you know, I think Boone did a good job, and the Yankees won a lot of games. And, you know, it did seem that when they got to the division series, they sort of abandoned the game plan and the blueprint a little bit at times. So maybe that's something that he improves upon this year.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I admit, as a fan, I got a little bit frustrated, especially after Girardi handled the bullpen well, but the human side there was obviously missing with his players, and I thought you definitely saw that in some of their responses after they came back against the Indians. But, you know, speaking about the human side of the game, you have the MVP machine coming out this year, and before that, you wrote The Only Rule Is It Has to Work, which I know Ryan and I both read and we both loved, and one of the things that really stuck out to me, and I know we spoke about this, has been the human side of the game. And it wasn't a book that was about, I mean, to me, it's not a book that was just about running a baseball team by stats, but it was more about your adventure and the player's response to how to handle that and how to be a leader and things like that. And I mean, you know, the book's performance speaks for itself, a New York Times bestseller. Were you surprised, being that that was your first book, the reaction that it got? I mean, it's nothing but positive things on Amazon, a bestseller. What was your reaction to, I guess, the book's reception?
Well, of course, we were anxious. I mean, going into the project, we didn't know how the season would play out, and there was a lot of uncertainty even halfway through the season when we were having a really tough time getting our ideas through. You know, are we going to have anything to write about? What is this book going to be? It definitely did turn out to be different than we had envisioned it. We had thought of it more as a stats book and what happens when you run a team a certain way. And really, as you said, it turned out to be more about the difficulty of implementing that kind of change and the negotiation and the diplomacy that comes into it. So, you know, I'm very pleased with the reception to the book and that it's meant something to people. I think that we had high hopes initially just because the idea was so exciting to us. And I think it was easy for us to convey to other people, even if they weren't big baseball fans. I think everyone kind of got the idea of, hey, just a couple of nerds who've never worked for a baseball team in any real capacity going in and making all the decisions. I mean, it's something that I think a lot of people, you know, could envy or could imagine themselves doing, because we all watch our sports teams and we all kind of play GM and play manager and think this is what we would do and, oh, we could do it better. And, you know, we actually got the chance to do that at one of the lowest levels of professional baseball. So I think we were really excited about the idea, and I think people were intrigued by the premise. So we just had to not screw it up, and we did screw it up, but it turned out that screwing it up actually made for a more interesting book.
We're talking with Ben Lindbergh of The Ringer and Effectively Wild. Before we let you go, Ben, you also write about video games for The Ringer, and Sean and I just recently finished the Spider-Man game for PS4. If you've played it, just wanted to get your thoughts on it. I think Sean and I agree that it was one of, if not our favorite, one-player storyline game, and was just wondering your thoughts on it.
I did play it, and I did enjoy it. I wrote something about it for The Ringer. I wrote specifically about just the web-slinging mechanic, because I thought that worked so well. So I talked to some of the developers about how they managed to perfect that. But I thought it was great. I never ended up playing the DLC, because it came out right when I was in the middle of trying to finish the book. It was terrible timing, so I've been looking forward to that. I just kind of went into media deprivation mode for a few months, and now I'm catching up on everything I missed. So I think I will revisit that, but it was great. As a New Yorker, it was fun to just swing around a city that looked like one I'm very familiar with, and I thought they really nailed that mechanic. I'm not a huge comic book superhero guy, despite my nerdiness in other areas, but I was definitely grabbed by the story, and I thought they just did a really great job with it. I liked Spider-Man 2. I liked some early Spider-Man games, but I thought this was probably the one that made the most of the license.
Yeah, the DLCs were good. I recommend them. They dwindle some of the Mary Jane sneak arounds too. So they were good.
Yeah, stealth missions are never my strong suit in video games.
No, me neither. Thanks so much, Ben. That's Ben Lindbergh from The Ringer and Effectively Wild. He has the MVP machine coming out soon that he and Travis Sawchick wrote, and Sean and I have pre-ordered our copy. Everyone else should too. Ben, thanks again. We really appreciate the time.
Thank you. Good talking to you guys. Thanks, Ben.
All right, that was Ben Lindbergh, and huge thanks to him, as always. Insightful stuff, as you'll hear on Effectively Wild if you ever listen to him there, and any of his articles on The Ringer or his new book that's coming out. But Sean, it seems like the Yankees played a pretty big part in his book, The MVP Machine, which I don't think is very surprising considering the known size of the Yankees' analytical staff and how much they're putting into player development. And like you pointed out to me before we started recording, that commitment has already started to show on the field based on the Yankees' homegrown talent that have begun to perform in the majors.
Yeah, I mean, the Yankees obviously are going to be cautious with guarding their information, as Ben alluded to. And I wasn't really surprised by that. I'm sure you're not either. But I wish I had the time to go through it, but I was thinking about it. And if you think about the Yankees player development from the 2005 to 2014 season, I mean, if you think about the Yankees that were like truly homegrown or came over, you have really of impact players only Cano, Gardner, Phil Hughes, and Robertson and Betances, I would say. I mean, Chamberlain had an effective month. Melky Cabrera was never really anything big. But then you look at what's happened since then. I mean, Sanchez went on the Babe Ruth tear. Judge, Torres, Andujar. They've had so much production come up from the farm system through player development that it's really encouraging. And I think the only discouraging part is, which we touched on with Ben, is that it kind of gives the Yankees an out to not spend as much money.
Yeah, I agree. The Red Sox have that same young core too, but they complemented it with contracts like J.D. Martinez, and obviously that was a huge difference last year. So, you know, as Ben Lindbergh said, it seems like the rest of baseball would follow a team like the Yankees because they are the wealthiest and the team that had usually in the past went out and spent that money on free agents, and other teams used to have to counter, but it seems like that might not be the case anymore, and the Yankees are playing a big part in what could be a coming work stoppage in baseball. And then you have Aaron Boone yesterday saying that the Yankees are done adding pieces, and that would obviously mean no Bryce Harper, no Manny Machado. So I feel like this is kind of
all related.
Fact. Yeah, I feel like it's all related, and I feel like it's a statement that we kind of all assumed anyway based on how this has been going recently. But what were your thoughts on kind of seeing that another nail in the coffin of Harper or Machado in pinstripes?
I I really don't trust when people say that kind of stuff. So it doesn't, I'm just kind of, it's just like, you know, if he was like, yeah, we're still looking to reel in some big fish, that would send up alarms and antennas all over to, you know, all the other teams and everything like that.
the funny thing is though, would it? Because the Yankees have said that they're going big game hunting, that they're a fully operational Death Star, and then they get DJ LeMahieu and Troy Tulowitzki. So I'm almost feeling like if he did say that, I'd feel worse about the Yankees' chances.
That's fair, but I don't know. I mean, you know, Cashman likes to play the short game, and I mean, I guess when he said fully operational Death Star, he meant bullpen, because that's really where the Yankees have invested. And
yeah,
you know, they made the big trade for Paxton, which is exciting. But I don't know if you saw Lindsay Adler's article.
I did.
Paxton, that was really good. Already becoming one of my favorites. But yeah, well, I mean, we'll see. I don't really trust that they're done. I think they're going to add another depth piece to the rotation at a minimum. And I think if the price comes down, they'll land one more guy, on Harper or Machado. I'm still holding out hope, man. Yeah, there's no reason for them not to, if the price keeps falling. And I don't know. I just keep thinking. Now, did you see the projections on Harper and Machado over a 10-year period? It's actually projected that Harper will produce more wins above replacement. What did you think about that?
Yeah,
because I know you've been a Machado guy, and you kind of swayed me, but I like Harper more. I'm just like, huh?
Yeah, and again, this is just going off the numbers that they've produced in their careers up to this point. I could see Harper becoming even more of a monster at Yankee Stadium if he were to come to New York, but. You know, Machado just leading all of baseball in plate appearances over the last 7 years. He's always out on the field. He showed when he went to the Dodgers, to a team that puts him in a position to be good in the infield by shifting a lot, and the Orioles were one of the teams that were lagging behind in that area. His defense dramatically improved, and Machado has just been a more consistent hitter, I feel like. You know, Harper had that incredible 2015, one of the best offensive seasons of all time. He was great at points last year and in 2017, but you know, he does have some pretty big gaps in month spans over the years where he hasn't been productive. And again, it's I would take either one of them, but it's just, you know, you have to choose one, and that's just who I would go with. I am a little surprised that they that was the projections for Harper and Machado, but hey, again, I would be fine with either one.
Yeah, and I mean, it's close enough, you know, wins above replacement, you know, either one, you're not going wrong, and you're still getting good value on the contract, so I'm good with either one. And you know, we did talk about Mr. Boone with Ben, and I'm hoping too for a little improvement out of on the bench there with him as well. Which, you know, it seems like having a little bit seasoning maybe will help. So, you know, we'll see. But, you know, it's something that I'm glad we talked about, because I feel like we're very negative about the state of baseball in terms of signings and stuff like that for the Yankees. But it is an improvement over the way things were when, I mean, we got excited when Austin Romine came up. Now, I mean, we have all these guys that are our guys. And I don't know about you, but it definitely, you know, I never stopped loving the Yankees, but it definitely reinvigorated that like ultra diehard fandom where I'm like all about it all the time. Once they brought up guys like Judge.
Yeah.
It started with Bird, but Judge, Sanchez, Bird, you know, Severino. I didn't even mention him. It definitely feels like you have more ownership over the team just because these are guys that you've watched grow coming up through the system and everything like that.
Yeah, shockingly enough, it's more enjoyable to watch Gleyber Torres than Stephen Drew, or Miguel Andujar than Chase Headley, and Aaron Judge over Lyle Overbay in right field. So yeah,
Can't take his bat out of lineup.
Nope. So yeah, this has been it's definitely been fun these past 2 years to watch these guys turn into stars in the league. But again, now it's time to use your greatest strength, which is your money, and to go get other established superstars to catapult your team from in the mix to the above and beyond favorite.
I 100% agree, and you know, it's not over yet, but spring training opens up next Wednesday, so let's see if there's a couple more moves to pull. I know we talked about it last week. They've done some things at the beginning of spring training in the past, so we'll see if anything else is to follow.
Well, as you just said, pitchers and catchers report next week, so I mean, do I have to ask what you're looking forward to in the next week? Or, I mean, it is just pitchers and catchers reporting, but it's just kind of another one of those dates you can circle on the calendar that, says that baseball is one step closer to being back.
Yeah, we're chipping away. I mean, I saw videos of, Frazier, Bird, and Voit are already down there working out, which is exciting. And I think it just, you start to see guys throwing and then the games start, the spring training games. And even though I don't like to watch them because I can just check the stats because the games don't matter. And if I watch and somebody gets hurt, I'm just going to get upset. So, but it gives, it's just like, it's the feeling that the season's coming up and you start getting excited and seeing how rosters are and battles are taking place. And, we'll see if Frazier can win some more time in the outfield. That's something I definitely would be interested in. And if they give Stanton more time out there as well, that'd be another interesting thing to watch. So, yeah, what I'm looking forward to next week is just the official opening of spring training. And I'm sure that's what you are, too. And I won't say that you can't steal it because this is what we've been waiting for since October 11th or 12th or whenever they got knocked out.
Yep, no, that's mine, too. And I can't even think of anything else that I'm looking forward to because nothing's really going on anymore. But
it's such a dead period for sports right now. Up until we get to Selection Sunday, the week before when you have the conference tournaments in college basketball, there's really not much doing right now. But hopefully, you got the NBA trade deadline today, and hopefully some more baseball moves get made. But my question for you today is, who are your top three favorite Yankees on the team right now?
I'd say Didi, Judge would be top two, and CC.
Okay, cool.
What about you?
I'd pretty much copy and paste that, but I might flip Tanaka in for CC or Betances. I really like Betances a lot too.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with any of those guys.
I've always been a Gardner guy, but he's kind of been marginalized over the over the last couple of years just because he's older. But
yeah, hopefully he can provide some kind of production next year in what's hopefully a more limited role to maximize him at the plate. But anyway, that's all we got for episode 31. So thanks so much to Ben Lindbergh. That was a great interview and awesome to talk to him. And we will see who we bring on next week and as we become one step closer. So maybe when we depending on what day we record next week, there will be players on the field getting ready for the season. So that's exciting.
I'm pumped up to see them start to throw. Hopefully Chapman's knee is all fixed up too. I don't want to have to deal with that again.
Yeah, and Sanchez's shoulder.
Yeah, well, we'll take him along slow. So,
all right. Well, we will find out more with all that next week. Thanks everyone for listening, and we will talk to you next week.